This is Clusterfucked. Here's your host, Roger King.
Welcome to Clusterfucked. I am Roger King. As I promised in the intro episode, we get right down to business here at CF headquarters. So no rambling anecdotes about what I did on the weekend or some crazy thing I saw on the ride to the studio today. We get right to our guest, and I'm excited about who we have on the podcast today. He was chief strategist for George W. Bush's presidential reelection campaign in 2004, and he held that same role for Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in California in 2006. He is now chief political analyst for ABC News. You can usually see him most Sunday mornings as a panelist on ABC This Week with George Stephanopoulos. It's my pleasure to welcome Matthew Dowd. Matthew, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Great to be here. Always a pleasure.
So in this podcast, I talk about liberal clustering in two different ways. There's the literal clustering where liberals are living mainly in the big urban centers and not spread out enough around the country to win more elections. But there's also the figurative clustering, where liberals end up talking most of the time to people who already agree with them. And I argue here we need to do a better job of trying to persuade voters not already in our camp. And there are some liberals who argue, oh, that's a fool's errand in this era. You know, you're not going to persuade many Republicans. But you, Matthew, you went from reelecting George W. Bush, working at the highest levels of the Republican Party, to openly supporting the Democratic nominee Barack Obama in the very next election. I know you're an independent now, but can you take us back to that time and what made you transition from your work in the Republican Party to supporting the Democrats at the time?
Sure, and I think this is a great conversation because I think one of the big problems in America today, which obviously leads to polarization and leads to division and all of that, is the idea that people have a tendency, as a human tendency, to do confirmation bias, which is listen to what makes us comfortable in our own opinions and biases and ignore which makes us uncomfortable, which is people that might have a different opinion. And it affects the left and it affects the right. So it's a major problem, and it's so easy to do because of cable and then internet and radio and all of that. I spent most of my career, and I got interested in politics during Watergate when I was 12 years old, watching the Watergate hearings. And I said to myself, that's what I want to do. I want in some way get involved in politics. And ever since then, I started volunteering. I grew up in Detroit, started volunteering and doing lots of things. I went to college, worked for Dick Gephardt in college in St. Louis, and then worked for a series of Democratic candidates, mainly in Texas at first. Texas then, back then, was a blue state. I worked for Lloyd Benson, who was a Democratic senator from Texas, and worked for the joint ticket that he was on when Dukakis picked him, and worked for our lieutenant governor here, whose name was Bob Bullock, which in Texas, so a lot of people don't know this, in Texas, the lieutenant governor is elected separately from the governor and is actually the most powerful position in the state. He runs all the legislation and basically determine what passes in the legislature. And then I got to know Bush. I got out of politics, formed a couple of companies that I was blessed to have success in. And I got to know Bush because of my relationship with the lieutenant governor, who became a friend of mine. And I liked Bush and was out of politics at that point. And he and his campaign, as he was beginning to think about running for president, approached me and asked if I would help him as he was running for president. And I thought, oh, this is good. He's sort of brought divisions together in Texas, did a lot of things. Wouldn't that be great for the country? So I went to work for him. He was the first Republican in my life that I'd ever worked for. Worked for him for 5 years, but then had a rather public break with him over a number of things, but there were two main things, which ended up on the front page of the New York Times. We ran for office saying that we were going to bring the country together and unify, and the country ended up more divided, so we didn't accomplish what we said we were going to. And two, the Iraq War, which, as everybody knows, looking back, ended up to be probably one of the worst decisions in our country's history for a lot of different reasons, not only loss of men and women, but the cost and how it's affected the international community. And in that process, broke with him, went to work for Schwarzenegger, sort of really examined what I thought was good for the country, happened to have a meeting with Barack Obama at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas. We had they called up and asked if I would meet with him as he was thinking about running for president. This was in, I think, October of 2006, before he had decided. And we had a long conversation. He knew I was a fan of some of the things he had said. He gave this great speech on faith and how we need to reexamine faith and how we talk about it and how it's discussed in the public, in the public community, and ended up having a number of conversations with him, and then voted for him in the aftermath of all of that. He won. I didn't vote for him in 2012. I actually didn't vote for either major party candidate in 2016. Mm-hmm. And so that's the process of it. There's a lot of parts in play on it, but that's the process. I have considered myself an independent ever since the end of the Schwarzenegger race. So the last 12 years or so, I've been an independent. Incredibly concerned about what's going on today in what's happening in Washington, D.C. So and willing, as you probably know, or anybody that follows me on Twitter or watches me on ABC News, I'm willing to throw a flag at
either side
that has stepped out of line and is not doing what's in the best interest of the common good.
Well, I mean, one of your most consistent messages on Twitter and, you know, other things you write and say in other platforms is calling out for a return to civility in politics. You know, I'm with you 100%. You know, given what I'm trying to do here, it's really tough to persuade people who don't agree with you by, you know, yelling at them and calling them names. I'm interested in this era of Trump. Are you seeing any hopeful signs, any reason for optimism we might get back to a little more civility in American politics?
Well, I think the vast majority of the country is in that space. I don't think our politics today reflects where the country is, and there's many different things that are happening where what's happening in the conversation in politics is divorced from what's going on. I live in a community outside of Austin, a small rural town outside of Austin. I chose to live here because I like the place and I like the people, and it's Trump voters and Clinton voters and third-party voters that you go to church with, you go to see in the grocery store. I volunteer for a lot of local activities that people get along. They get along fine. They help each other out. And that's where most of the country is. We just don't have a political system today that allows for those majority of the voices, in my view, to be heard on a regular basis. I think I'm an optimist. I'm a born optimist. I'm hopeful. I believe in this country. I believe in the ideals of our country. I believe in the idea that we should be doing things to make a more perfect union. We don't have a perfect union. And so I believe in all of those things, but I think our leaders are completely out of sync with all. Mm-hmm. Most of our leaders are out of sync with where the country is. But I would say that, you know, President Bush got elected on a platform of healing the divides and bringing the country together. Barack Obama got elected on a vision of getting past red and blue and bringing the country together. And then we had an election in 2016 that was really not about that. And the end, and the result has been what we've seen over the course of the last 2+ years in this, which is, I think, incredibly concerning. But I think the 2018 election were actually a sign where when the majority of the country engages, they say, we don't want to go in this direction, which is why the Democrats, I think, won a historical election by a larger margin than any time in the last 100 years in 2018. And my hope is that candidates will emerge in 2020. And you're seeing a number of them talk this way.
Yeah.
That we need to bring the country together. We are at as divided as we were in the 1850s and early 1860s. We are at that point. We are as divided as we were in the run up to the Civil War.
Well, I wasn't going to dive into 2020 just yet. I was going to save that for a few minutes, but it does make me think. I want to bring up one thing. I'm seeing some messages of civility from at least some of the candidates. For example, certainly Beto O'Rourke is making that kind of pitch. Mayor Pete, bit of a sleeper pick candidate.
He's my dark horse pick.
Yeah, I love him. I think he's got a positive message. Obviously, Joe Biden has made some comments about how we can't ignore the other party and we need to tone it down. Let me just talk about 2020 for a second. In this sense, putting your strategist hat on, what would you advise in terms of these candidates? Trump is going to try to drag them down into the mud. Would you selectively attack Trump, or would you stay above the fray if you were advising whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be?
So as I look at it as a strategist and understanding where the country is, I think you have to do two things simultaneously. I think you have to be really careful about your tone and how you do it, but I think you have to be able to point out the damage that President Trump is doing and has done to our democratic institutions and what he has caused to unfold in our country today. I think you have to point that out clearly, strongly, and consistently. And then I think you also have to also make the argument you can think of Donald Trump like a forest fire and all the forest fires that happen because of climate change. Donald Trump is like a forest fire. Just putting out the forest fire isn't going to solve the problem. So you have to both be able to say, yes, we need to put out the forest fire, but let's understand what is the real cause of the things going on, and that's what we have to fix. And I think that there's a difference. I'm not one of these ones. I don't like the term centrist. I don't like most of the terms in politics. I don't like the term moderate. I think people like passion. I think you can speak passion with compassion. And I think it's just sort of this mealy mouth oatmeal sort of way of talking about it. Like, this is what, and pointing out aspects of all different sides. I don't think people want that. They want a clear, consistent message of what's happening today. And then you have to give them a picture of where you want to go and what you see. Because I think part of the problem today, and one of the reasons why we have a hard time bridging the divides, is that there's groups of voters that want quick transformational change. Understandably, the country's changing. It's getting more diverse, more open, more progressive, all of those sorts of things. And then there's a whole group of voters who are afraid of that change.
Mm-hmm.
By telling people to hurry up and come along and you're stupid to believe that is not going to solve the problem. I think we have to understand why people are afraid and figure out where to connect with a group of those people to help them see where we can go. And I think that's incumbent upon the leaders. And so I'm not one of these, as I said, I'm not one of these people that believes you shouldn't have passion, you shouldn't take definitive stands, you shouldn't have principles. I'm all for that, which I have my own. But in the end, you have to figure out what tone you use, how do you relate to people, and what type of way you want to communicate with people in a way that's going to bring people together as opposed to push them further apart.
Well, and I think that's, having mentioned Mayor Pete, for example, I see that tone with him. He's not apologetic about his views on, we have to do something about climate change and certain other issues, but he's doing it in a way that is civil and respectful. So you get the idea that he's passionate about it, but, he's not jamming it down anyone's throat either. In terms of issues, is there an issue or issues that you think Democrats really need to emphasize going forward in any of their political races, not just talking about presidential, something that will persuade voters not already in the Democratic camp and possibly something they aren't currently emphasizing that you as a strategist would think actually could work well for them?
So here's the mistake I think Democrats make a lot. Not always and not all the time, but they make a lot. And they think that Republicans have always been much better about making campaigns about values, and Democrats have always been interested in making them about issues. And most people vote for president, and most people vote for high offices based on values, big values. Are you tolerant? Do you understand where I am in my life? Are you a strong and decisive leader? Are sort of big, broad values that people sort of decide in their gut. I think the thing that Democrats have to do is figure out what value set they are running on and then take every issue, climate change, health care, the economy, gun control, whatever, any of those, all of those issues, and put them through the prism of values. And I think that's when campaigns are successful. As I said, for the last 30 or 40 years, Republicans, and as I say, not every election, not all the time, have been better about that in a national way than Democrats have been. And so I think it's what you have to decide first, what are your values and how do they relate to America, and then take your issue sets and funnel them through the sort of value alignment that you have with most voters.
So how would, say, climate change, how would they connect that to, a value thing like you're talking about, just to take an issue, for example?
And some do this well, and I actually have watched Jay Inslee, who's the governor of Washington, mm-hmm. and he talks about this well, how climate change affects everything, everybody's life, our families, our communities, our future. People always vote, and the funny thing about this is, and I talked about this in 2004 when I was doing the campaign, Ronald Reagan was only partially right when he asked the question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? We did a whole set of polling during the Bush campaign and sort of delved into how people look at that. And we asked it in four different ways about individually, are you better off than you were in the last few years? Is the country better off? Are you going to be better off in the next 4 years? Is the country going to be better off in the next 4 years? The most clearest avenue of all of those that indicated how somebody was going to be off was, is the country going to be better off in the next 4 years? That is what the Democrats, if they talk about climate change, they have to say, they cannot argue over the battle over the last 10 years or 20 years, but talk about climate change is who are we going to be? What world do we want to leave our children in the next 4, 8, 12, 20 years? What is that we want to leave? What do we want to leave for our families and our communities and our children? That's the way to talk about climate change. But I would argue that's the way to talk about everything. Mm-hmm. Talk about the economy. Talk about the economy, not what it's been the last 4 years or how it's going to individually impact a person, but what do you want the economy to look like in the next 4 years?
Take it to a larger place, yeah. Well,
And look future and not past.
Right. Absolutely. Well, and the debate that I'm seeing in liberal circles is sort of, as it relates to 2020 is, Trump is, pretty historically unpopular. He's a weak candidate for re-election. So the idea is, well, he's down, he's probably going to lose. Let's go big. This is our opportunity. Let's do a Green New Deal. Let's do all this. That's one camp saying that. And then the other camp is saying, look, we took Trump, we took him lightly last time. The priority is get him out of there. Let's play it safe. Let's go with someone who's just reasonable, experienced, and then we'll deal with the big issues. I don't know if that's the debate you're seeing. If so, where do you fall on that, which side?
So I think we need, I think limiting the conversation is never good. So I think we need we need leaders that can articulate both things. So we need leaders that want to articulate the art of the impossible, the big stuff, how big stuff. But then we also need leaders who know how to craft the possible. And saying, I'm all for talking about big aspirational things. But let's not ignore, we also need leaders that are enable in this moment to craft the possible. What can actually get done? What can actually get passed? How can we implement this in the country we're in today? The best leaders know how to do both. The best leaders know how to talk aspirationally and then sort of make the argument of, as we seek an aspirational goal, let's craft the possible. And so I think we need voices that represent both of those. And then national leaders that know how to mend those two together in a coherent message.
Well, and you talked about earlier, people liking big ideas, but sometimes being a little bit afraid of too drastic a change. I think we see that, with healthcare, for example, where in a general sense, the polling may say the nation is in favor of Medicare for all. But when you get down to it, you have a lot of people who get their insurance through their employers, and convincing them to abandon that in favor of a government program is a heavy lift, even if they may be in favor of it in a general sense.
Yeah, but I think there's a way. I think there's actually, I mean, the polling has shown that people want universal health care, and that continues to increase. I think there's a way to present a policy on that that basically seeks to make steps towards that. So you can have a Medicare option, Medicare an option for all, where people can choose. They can, if they want to stay in their private insurance, as we step more and more towards this, we can begin to let Medicare available to more and more people, begin to drop the eligibility of Medicare down as we pursue a big, broader goal that provides universal health care. And so I think politicians get caught in this thing of it's okay to say, yes, we want Medicare for all. And now let me explain the best way to get there. That's what I think they have to be able to do. They have to be able to say, yes, we need universal health care. Absolutely, everybody has a right to health care. You know, it's immoral that we're at a country where people are searching for health care and can't get access for a variety of means, not only facilities, but money. But let's take this and how we can move towards there in a step-by-step process.
That's the combination you talked about, where it's aspirational, it's the big idea, but here's how we're going to do it incrementally. Let's talk Texas for a moment, given that's where you live. The tagline of this podcast is a liberal host, but with red state guests. So you definitely qualify. Democrats were, you know, excited last fall at the prospect of, you know, Beto O'Rourke beating Ted Cruz. And he came up a little short, but obviously things are looking more positive in Texas. Do you think it's realistic to think of Texas as a swing state in 2020, whether Beto O'Rourke is the nominee or not? Are you going to give it official swing state status?
Unlikely. I mean, obviously, we'll have to see where things stand in the fall of 2020. Unlikely. I mean, if Texas is a swing state, you're already at 270 electoral votes. You've already achieved that a lot, because if Texas is a swing state, that means you've already you're way ahead in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Iowa. But Texas is moving in that direction. I think it's still a little early. Texas will be purple. Texas will definitely be purple. I think the outside limit of that is 8 years. So 8 years from now or 7 years from now, it will be a purple state. Beto O'Rourke's campaign and who he is, I think, has put that move, made that move faster than it would have been otherwise. But I still think 2020, if you take a list of all the states for Democrats and list them out by blue to dark red, you're going to have draw a line at 270 or 300 electoral votes before you get to a lighter red Texas.
Right. And of course, you know, if the nominee simply wins back those three Rust Belt states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, they've got the 270 already.
Roger, I want to also add one thing about red states and blue and all of that. Mm-hmm. Is progressives can win, progressive candidates can win in red jurisdictions, let's say. If they're progressive on issues, but they culturally align with the state or the district. And I think that's what I think many times people ignore. You can be in Texas and be for gun reform. You can be in Texas and be for universal health care. You can be in Texas and have a more equitable tax system. But you have to be culturally aligned with the state. This is like the difference between Connor Lamb, the congressman who won in a red district in Pennsylvania, who was progressive on many issues. He wanted to have a Medicare option. He wanted to have gun control. He wanted to have a number of things, but he culturally was aligned with the district. People could see him as a person from that district, just like you have to be able to see somebody if you're running in Texas or you're running in Georgia or you're running wherever you're running. You can be progressive on issues. You just have to make sure you're linked culturally with people. It's like why Ann Richards, one governor of Texas. She was a very liberal, very progressive person, but she was very culturally aligned with the state.
Well, and it all gets back to some of the things we've been talking about civility and making the case persuasively, you know, not yelling at people, you know, respecting where they're at and their viewpoints. Just while I have you, the Electoral College, just wanted to touch on that for a second, because you recently wrote a piece on abcnews.com about the idea of abolishing the Electoral College. And, you know, I'm in agreement with you. And the one thing I liked about the piece was how you talked about what the election campaign itself would be like if the country moved to a popular vote system. I find a lot of people, when they're defending the Electoral College, they spend all this time talking about, you know, why the founders set it up. We all know that the debate is about, is it still, you know, relevant, and should we still conduct our elections this way? So maybe just go over a little bit how you feel a campaign would actually play out if we move to a popular vote, one person, one vote kind of system.
Sure. And so in my main thing of that column that I wrote, and I've talked about it since that column I wrote, is that, you know, Elizabeth Warren announced that let's abolish the and the Electoral College, and everybody, radical idea, radical idea, radical idea. Well, the first point I want to make is moving towards a more popular vote model is not a radical idea. It's where a majority of the country is.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of the country wants a popular vote model instead of an Electoral College model. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we're not going to abolish the Electoral College anytime soon. That would require 3/4 of the states to do it. That is not going to happen. So, I mean, I think we probably ought to take that off the table in that specific discussion, but there are ways to make the Electoral College more in alignment with a popular vote model. And the way it changes the campaigns, everybody makes the assumption, not everybody, many people make the assumption that the Electoral College forces people to go to smaller states to pursue it, and it gives smaller states greater weight in the campaign process. The exact opposite has come to happen, which means that basically in 2020, if you run on the Electoral College, under the Electoral College system, which is where we are today, it means that both major parties' presidential candidates will spend 90% of their time and 90% of their resources in only 5 or 6 states. Five or six states will be everything will be aimed at those 5 or 6 states.
Right.
Under a popular vote system, if you ran a campaign, and I thought about this as if I were running a campaign for president of the United States, you would put your resources in probably 40 states. And so you would be talking about to people across the country. You would not only be where today Texas and California and New York aren't even in the equation. Missouri is not even in the equation. Kentucky is not even in the equation of pursuit of voters, and those would go on the table where Democrats and Republicans would have to go to Texas.
They only go there for fundraising, and that's it at this point.
They raise money, and so and you would have to campaign throughout the country. You'd probably have national ad buys, which means the entire country would be involved in the communication of that way. Travel would have to be all over. But I think people, I mean, when people argue back to me and say, well, all the small states will be ignored, and I ask that this is usually coming from today from Trump supporters, all the small states will be ignored. And I ask, when's the last time a presidential candidate from either party went to North Dakota, South Dakota, Idaho, Wyoming,
Delaware,
Missouri,
yeah.
Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama? They never go. So that's not, under a popular vote model, candidates will still have to go to Michigan. They'll still have to go to Wisconsin. They'll still have to go to Pennsylvania. They'll still have to go to those states that are in that. They'll still have to go to Florida. But now they'll add 35 or more other states that they have to compete in.
Well, and the other argument you hear is that, you know, New York and California will decide the elections, forgetting, of course, that Texas is the second largest state. Florida is just as large as New York, so, and they're both red states. So it's evenly divided that way. And as you say, I think the strategies would be fascinating. You know, you can get the same number of people that are in California if you go to Texas, Louisiana, in that region. It'd be interesting, endless types of strategies that, you know, strategies like yourself would have to figure out how to reach the most people and which combinations of states and all that.
Yeah, and the other thing it would do is it would actually be a campaign strategy that helps bring the country together. Because instead of just concentrating on only a small number of states, you would actually have to, campaigns would have to go to Houston, as well as LA, as well as Madison, Wisconsin, as well as St. Louis, Missouri. So they would be exposed to a greater group of voters and a greater group of people that would have them understand the country more as a whole and sell a very limited campaign in a very number of limited areas.
Mm-hmm. Before I let you go, let's just do a little bit on 2020. Of course, we got to do that. I guess some people have said that having so many candidates is a negative, and it's just, a crowded debate stage and all the rest. I think it's, for the most part, a positive thing. The only thing I'm worried about, and love to get your take on it, is the Democratic delegate system, of course, is that they award them proportionally. So you win a state, it's not winner take all. So we have a number of candidates who've proven quite clearly they can fundraise, they have a base of support. So I see a scenario where this could drag out quite a long time with a number of candidates getting a reasonable amount of delegates where they can argue they should stay in the race, and of course leading eventually to some kind of contested convention. Now, of course, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but do you see that as a possibility? Where are you at on that?
Well, just a few things fairly real fast. First, I think multiple candidate fields, large fields, are usually better for the in an open race than in a smaller field. You take a look at history and take a look at where these things have happened before. There was, 16, 17 candidates ran in 1992. There was 9 or 10 candidates that ran in 1976. I mean, you multi-cannibal fields bring a lot of excitement. And so I think that addresses that. I think the odds that nobody has enough delegates on the first ballot, I think, is very high. Mm-hmm. I think that's likely. Because for a number of reasons. One, Democrats do a proportional way they get delegates. So if somebody gets 33% of the vote, they get roughly 33% of the delegates. And so with a multi-candidate field, unlike the Republicans who do a lot of winner-take-alls, the ability to put it away in a process is hard. And then you add to that superdelegates no longer can vote on the first ballot. So all the other ways that people were able to accumulate delegates fast in the Democratic nomination process was mainly contingent on superdelegates flocking to one over another in the course of that process. That doesn't exist on the first ballot. So the odds that somebody on the first ballot, a Democrat on the first ballot, is going to have enough delegates to win is very low. Mm-hmm. I actually think that depending on how the campaign unfolds, and as long as everybody comes together and seeds with somebody that wins, so it depends on the campaign unfold, no telling what that is. I think that could cause it, from a coverage standpoint, from somebody in ABC News, that is an incredible convention to cover and could create a huge amount of excitement in a convention over the course of those 4 or 5 days that people are in convention, that nobody is necessarily locked in, and then you have a convention and you come out of a convention. I think that's an exciting prospect for the Democrats, as long as everybody comes out of the convention unified.
What could possibly go wrong? I appreciate you taking the time, Matthew. Really do. Really enjoyed the chat. I look forward to continuing to hear your thoughts on Twitter. If you want to follow Matthew Dowd, it's at Matthew J. Dowd. And of course, on ABC News every week and other platforms. Matthew, thanks again for joining me on this podcast.
Great to be here. And just one thing, because both of us have a connection to Detroit. Albert Kahn's birthday is today, who is considered the architect of Detroit, did the Fisher Building, I think did 100 different buildings in Detroit. It's his birthday today.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's fate. We were supposed to do it. Thank you. Yes, a couple of Motor City guys chatting about politics. Thanks again. I appreciate it.
Take care. Bye.
And there's Matthew Dowd, former strategist for the George Bush reelection campaign and now political director of ABC News. Again, on Twitter, if you want to follow him, at Matthew J. Dowd. Speaking of which, you can follow your esteemed host there as well. My moniker is the Civil Liberal, which I'm sure Matthew would appreciate, but the actual handle is at CF the Podcast. That's at CF the Podcast. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes or find out anything else about Clusterfucked, go to cfthepodcast.com. That's cfthepodcast.com. And at that site, there is an opportunity to support the podcast. This is a labor of love. I have no big financial backer or advertiser. There are some expenses. I record in an actual recording studio, the fine folks at dbaudio.ca, which means an engineer and editor. We have the website, which means website design, updates, hosting fees. We're attempting to do a little marketing, get the word out. You get the idea. So if you like what you hear, just click on that button, support us. We do appreciate it. And we won't bombard your inbox, don't worry. Only official correspondence from Clusterfucked headquarters. Really appreciate you taking the time to listen.
The Clusterfucked Podcast, a liberal host with red state guests.
I'm Roger King. That'll be all.